The stories you are about to listen to were recorded live at the U.S. Coast Guard Base in Ketchikan, Alaska, on September 20th, 2015. Stories at Latitude 56 is a program based on traditional storytelling. Community members share mostly true stories from their experiences and are mentored to find their narrative, to hone it, and to successfully share it with a live audience. In today's world of enhanced and almost constant digital communication, storytelling is an art form that requires active listening and builds vibrant emotional connections. By exploring creative expression through the art of storytelling, we hope to open a window into the essence of Ketchikan. You will be hearing stories by Rebecca Bolin, Kirsten Baltz, Dana Fitzpatrick, and Matt Eisenhower. Stories at Latitude 56 is a presentation of the Ketchikan Area Arts and Humanities Council. The host of Stories at Latitude 56 is Dana Fitzpatrick.
Our series is based off of a storytelling series based in New York called The Moth. Have any of you heard of The Moth? A couple. Okay. So The Moth is a storytelling collective, and it's based off of a guy, George Dawes Green, who in 1997 wanted to recreate the feeling of a patio in the South, where the moths would come through the screen and would be attracted to the light, as many of you are attracted to the humanity of people as they come in to tell their life stories. And so it's a really great analogy for how, like, that slowness and that time that we spend together to really experience something very personal or very funny or just very real. And so there's a little bit of memoir. There's certainly a little bit of theater, a little bit of art, and a whole lot of humanity. And so that's what we're here today, is that we had felt with the Arts Council that there was so much just great humanity and diversity of experience in Ketchikan that we wanted to create a forum to share that. And so I hope you'll enjoy. We have four speakers today. We are going to start with Rebecca Bolin, who is going to kick us off today. And we're also going to hear from Kirsten Baltz, Matt Eisenhower, and myself. So with that, let me turn it over to Rebecca.
Late August, 1979, Iowa. Juniors and seniors were huddled in the gymnasium on the bleachers in the main gym. It was the start of a new school year, and all of the classes had been selected except for PE. Required for 4 years, physical education ranked right up there with English and religion. And at my high school, apparently, those were the three most important things to learn in life: the English language, God, and physical exertion. Though in what order of importance, none of us really were sure. My friends Margaret, Claire, and I were really excited because as juniors and upperclassmen and women, we were allowed to have co-ed class for PE. We were no longer sequestered to the freshmen and sophomores where you were gender separated and wearing, for the girls, the one-piece cotton zip-up uniforms. All four PE teachers sat behind tables on the gym floor, waiting for the chatter to die down amidst all of the students. It seems simple enough. Four teachers, four PE options. And we were pretty okay with what the options were going to be because the options were relegated to the teachers who also coached. So when Miss Mack flipped up her placard that stated she would be teaching volleyball, I wasn't surprised, but being my basketball coach, you know, I figured I'd had enough of her during practice and enough of the bumps, set, and spikes she would bring to that particular class. And when Miss Chris flipped up the placard that said cross country, I said, no, 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 no. I am a cross-country runner. I am on the team. I do not need three-day practices, as we already had twice a day. So waiting for Mr. Sisler and Mr. Brainerd to flip up their placards, we waited in anticipation because it was co-ed PE. But our excitement soon dwindled to disappointment as Sisler flipped up his, and it said, weightlifting. And Brainerd said, flag football. Now, that would not have been an issue, except underneath each one of those placards in small writing were the words, boys only. So we mentally, in our heads at that time, 16-year-old girls on a mission for justice, did the math. And in 1972, we did know that our school was then 7 years behind the times with Title IX. My friend Margaret swore under her breath. I became indignant. And Claire, the meekest of us all, stood up in those bleachers, turned around to us and said, "This is unfair. We need to talk to Brainerd." And the three of us, with our bodies working faster than our brains, stomped on those bleachers and stood in front of Brainerd like this and waited for one of us to say something. Everyone behind us became very still. And Claire, the meekest of us all, she'd lost her nerve. But she spoke up first. And instead of sounding very indignant and very righteous, was more like going to a bless me, Father, I have sinned confessional box. "Mr. Brainerd, please, sir, we really want to play football. Please." Me? I was not a very bold teenager, but I did have a pretty good rapport with many of my teachers. I felt it was my turn to maybe back Claire up at this point, and I said, "Mr. Brainerd, please, we know about Title IX. You need to honor it and let us play." Brainerd at that point was tapping the pen, spinning the paper around, cocking his shoulder and head toward cross country. He was about to say something, but Margaret, the bold one, the oldest of nine in a very Catholic family, and all of them with the middle name of Joseph or Mary, whichever gender it fell to at that time, said, "Brainerd, you have to let us sign up. If you don't, you cannot prove us wrong." So he rolled his eyes, flipped the paper around, and handed Margaret the pen. We quickly scribbled our names, and everyone just started coming down those bleachers behind us. But our elation at winning, at leveling the playing field, was short-lived, because at that point, we started hearing all of the negative comments and seeing the dirty looks thrown in our way. "Way to ruin football, Margaret. Can't get a date the real way, Beck?" Ooh, that hurt. "What's your problem, Claire? Jeez." Well, you know, in those cliched 80s fashioned, we really did have the cliched cliques at our school. The jocks just wanted to get on with signing and getting into the locker rooms. The ones who didn't care just wanted to sign up and go outside for a smoke before the next class. And the girls who pretended to be on your side for everything, they didn't want to play football because they wanted to get dates with those boys. We just wanted to play football. It was how we were raised. The next day, the true test came. That morning, everyone at the school had known and had heard how three 16-year-old idiots had taken on Brainerd, teacher of 20 years, coach of everything, taught health. How could we do this? But we did. And so, third hour rolled around. We walk outside, trailing Brainerd and the boys, Claire and I counting, 27 boys, 3 girls. We had stood up for our rights, but obviously the playing field still wasn't quite balanced. However, we did put our faith in Coach Brainerd. A man known for his humor, he was gruff but fair. And he made everybody at school feel a part of things, even if he didn't want to. So we're on the field, beyond the parking lot, blazing sun, late August morning. He quickly reviews the rules between regulation football and flag football and eyes those varsity players quite seriously, divides the 30 students into 2 teams, and mercifully puts Claire, Margaret, and I on the same team, much to our relief. Our team loses the toss. We're defending. Brainerd chooses a captain for each team. Our captain gives every single boy on the team a position, looks at the three of us and says, "Just run after somebody." At that point, we were just fine with whatever he told us. So we're on the line. The ball is snapped. And who does it go to but the senior varsity running back? Not only the running back, but the tailback of our team. That is ranked fifth in the state. A measly Catholic little high school who plays 5A football in Iowa because they have such a good team. In our desperation, Margaret and I decide we're just going to go all out. We didn't think we had a chance, but we soon found out our cross-country practice was coming into play. So we charge after him, and we're finding out that, you know, when the boys are on the field and they don't have that gear, they don't look like men on Sunday afternoon. They look like boys. And the faster we ran, the closer we got to Matt. And in our desperation, we got on either side of him, and we got those yellow flags, and we yanked those flags blindly. We had them in our hands. We turned around to find Claire trailing us in the dust. We'd done something. We'd proven ourselves. We walk back to Claire. The whistle is blown in all the midst of all the confusion. And we look over to Brainerd because play has stopped, and he is laughing. He is laughing, but not laughing at us. He is laughing and pointing behind us. We turn around, and behind us is a circle of boys around Matt in a huge dog pile, not of "you idiot, you let girls get the best of you," but he had lost his shorts as well as the flags. And I don't know about the women in here, but did you know that guys in high school who play football, they don't wear underwear under their shorts at PE? Now, we didn't see any of that because we were so desperate to prove ourselves, not only to the boys and to Brainerd, but mostly to ourselves, that we belonged there. And I would like to say that every day after that first day on the gridiron was as eventful as that, but it wasn't. School and life and football continued on its rocky trajectory in all its high school glory. There were ups and downs, of course. It might have been the end of inequality for girls for a moment. But it was also the beginnings of other things. For when second quarter options rolled around, Clint and Craig and Sean all challenged Miss Chris and were able to join the girls-only gymnastics class for PE. Thank you.
I want to go ahead and introduce our next speaker, Kirsten Baltz, who is has been in Ketchikan for a couple years now and has a really interesting background. Kirsten, please join us.
Somewhere between Homer and Seward, off the tip of Gore Point, a small 30-foot gill netter was longline fishing in 10-foot seas. Every few minutes, you could hear, punctuated by the winds, the yells of my dad and his best friend, Mike, as yet more green water poured over the stern of the boat. I was nestled in the hold, my small 10-year-old, 70-pound self attempting to wrestle halibut that were at least twice my size over the rails and into the ice. Every few moments, my attempted manhandling was interrupted as yet another fish nearly dropped on my head, usually accompanied by the less than useful advice of, "Put your back into it." "This is not how physics works." In one particularly memorable moment, with a combination of proper leverage and a well-timed wave, I ended up ass over tea kettle with a 200-pound flatfish on top of me, just in time for my dad to look down and yell, "Stop f***ing around." It was at this formative moment, at an age when I was just beginning to form ideas about how life should be, that I thought to myself for the first time, "This is bullshit." This ill-conceived trip began decades before my birth in a small town outside of Sacramento, back in the 60s before urban sprawl turned rich farmland into endless suburbs. My dad and Mike lived across the street from one another. They grew up picking fruit and vegetables from surrounding farms. They both ended up in the military eventually for less than voluntary reasons. After their service, they decided that Alaska was the place to be. They both tried their hands at commercial fishing with varying degrees of success. However, in the meantime, both had managed to meet the mothers of their future children, and this was just the latest in a long string of highly questionable child-rearing experiments. Mike had just returned from Alaska with a clean bill of health after his sixth round of chemo with his third round of cancer. He flew back to Alaska while leaving his wife Mimi and two boys to drive all of their belongings back up from Chicago. He claimed that after such an exhausting trial, all he wanted to do was to spend a summer in Alaska. My father and I ran into him at the local doctor's office. I had an ear infection, and he claimed that he was just having a routine checkup. This being the first time they had seen each other in several months, it of course turned into a 45-minute-long bullshit session, which ended with a statement, "We should go fishing. Let's go tomorrow." The following morning found me dressed in my Grundins and extra tufts aboard Mike's small longliner named the Wildcat. In years previous, I had asked him why his boat was named after a cat. He had said it was named after his wife. Years later, I wished I had never asked. The day was spent baiting gear and listening to Mike and my dad exchange stories that were probably inappropriate for young ears. I spent the day getting yelled at for not correctly remembering how to attach herring to a hook, for not wearing gloves, for wearing too many gloves, and then eventually for falling asleep in a bait bucket. Before we left for the evening, I heard Mike whisper, "I'm dying." I turned back to look at why he would say such a thing, and it didn't look like he had said anything at all. By this point, my dad was already halfway to the car, and I didn't want to get left at the boat for the evening, so I quickly ran after my dad. By the time I was buckled in, I had vanquished the incident from my memory. At such a young age, I was not equipped to deal with such an emotional quagmire. The next morning we were off. The day dawned bright and clear. The water was glassy, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. This is never a good sign of things to come. The trip around Gore Point took about 10 hours, and by the time we started setting the first set, the wind had started to pick up. By the time we started hauling gear, it was absolute misery. This went on for 3 days. When it was, at long last, time to head home, the two adults on the trip decided that their time would best be spent sleeping and to let the 10-year-old drive. After all, why else would they buy an autopilot? It's not like I was going to hit a rock, right? I didn't hit a rock. I did almost run into a tanker, however. After spending 3 days of getting yelled at, I was loath to wake the snoring men up. After all, if they were snoring, they weren't yelling. It wasn't until I was about 500 yards off the bow of the tanker that I thought perhaps, okay, I should probably wake them up. I'm not going to make it around the front of this. However, the tanker's horn did that for me. This resulted in a large amount of swearing, in yelling, and the less than kind question of, "What the beep were you thinking?" And eventually led to me being kicked out of the cabin to the stern of the ship to think about what I had almost done. The only thing I thought was, "This is bullshit." On the upside, I didn't have to drive the rest of the way in. 3 hours later found me much colder and once again in the hold as my dad and I began offloading halibut. My dad slung fish into the brailer bags with an ease that bordered on insulting after my hours of thankless toil. He mentioned casually about how weak Mike seemed. Back in the day, he could swing the denizens of the deep around with one arm and not break a sweat. These days, he seemed to struggle with the smaller ones. I did not put this and Mike's comment at the doctor's office together. As this last chore was being finished, Mike had went up top to talk to the plant manager about how much we may be getting paid for this misguided adventure. Before he left, he asked if my dad and I would finish cleaning the boat, as he wasn't feeling well and thought he should stop by the hospital. Before he left, he rustled my already knotted hair and looked at my dad and said, "I hope she's just like you." This was the last time I ever saw Mike. A few days later, the sun was out, the day was clear, and it was a rare windless day in Homer. I had just come in from outside, setting my tent up, which was where I was planning on sleeping for the rest of the summer, when my dad got a call from Mike's brother. Mike had been medevaced to Anchorage. He was completely unresponsive. An MRI showed that cancer had invaded every organ of his body. Halfway through the conversation, Mike's brother hung up. When we finally got him back a few moments later, Mike was gone. This is the first time I had ever seen my dad cry. It fell to my father to call Mike's wife, Mimi, who was still on a road trip between Chicago and Homer. She had thought she was coming home to a healthy man, so she had taken her time with the drive. As far as I know, their car is still somewhere in the Yukon. In the intervening weeks, as his funeral and services were planned, our home filled with family and friends and stories of Mike. My dad was one of the most avid storytellers. His tales of their misspent youth brought people to tears, both of happiness and sadness. When the day of the memorial finally rolled round, my dad declined to speak. I asked him why. He said he wasn't Superman. A few years ago, at the bar, because what good story doesn't start with a bar? I asked Mimi if anyone had ever told her about Mike's last fishing trip. When I finished the tale, she said, "It's a good thing Mike died when he did. I would have killed him for that." I then asked her if she knew Mike was dying. She said no. He had sworn he had a clean bill of health and that his cancer was in remission. I then haltingly told her what I had heard that day on the boat as we were leaving. I had spent over a decade scared of what her reaction might be. Mimi means more to me than the woman I call my mother, and I thought she would disown me for this. Instead, she hugged me and said, "Maybe Mike didn't say anything at all. Maybe it was just the universe asking for your understanding." Thank you.
You told me I killed her. The cold science that is cancer and the hot emotion of a teenager will never live together. Revisionist memories tell me that there were more good times than bad, but yet I look for justifications for the good, for the sacred, or the close. The mother-daughter relationship permanently trapped in the angst of teenage adolescence. Conversations that didn't happen. Peace that wasn't found. My first thoughts about my hands were that they weren't big enough. Anytime I attempted to do some sort of task in the kitchen, my mom would just snicker and say, "Your hands aren't big enough yet." My eyes could hardly peek over the counter, and yet I had hoped to peel carrots with the graceful utility that she could. I must have spent a lot of time admiring her hands because they are my most distinct memory. Most of the memories are a flood of anecdotes. How she would answer the phone, "Kelly, summer home, summer not." How she cut the grilled cheese horizontally and vertically instead of diagonally, like a window pane. The days the windows weren't quite shut when we went through the car wash. How she would lay in her posture when she would read books on the floral brown couch. How the best part of being sick was you could wear her gray hooded sweatshirt. The evening walks, or how she came to applesauce making day in elementary school. or seeing beaches and being embarrassed that she cried in the middle of a movie theater. The structured handwriting of an engineer, her Bob Dylan record collection, how she cried when I gave away the pink craft for Mother's Day to my grandmother because I wanted to get her something real from the store. How I forgot her last birthday because I was consumed with whatever a new high schooler is at that moment. In January of my freshman year in high school, she went to the hospital for stomach pain. I think it was a Monday, and I was off from school because of a snow day. To be honest, I wasn't worried. Neither my mom or dad made any indication that it was something to be concerned about. And I remember babysitting that week and studying for finals. On Thursday, I was supposed to go visit her for the first time, and instead of spending the whole afternoon with her, I went to choir practice and then went out to eat with a bunch of friends. By the time I finally showed up at the hospital, my brothers and my dad were there. We sat and we chatted about lighthearted things or why there was a tube coming out of her nose. Again, I didn't think much of that. The conversation was light and casual. I didn't realize the impact of that conversation or the lost opportunity of never having a final one-on-one time with her. Later that night, I was preparing for my first all-nighter Latin cram, a pattern that would exhibit itself time and time again. The phone rang, and I didn't pay much attention. My father started to wake my brothers. I was brushing my wet hair, and David Letterman was on TV. I figured my mom was having surgery, and since I had asked to be able to go, if that was the case, I started to blow dry my hair. 12-year-old Paul stood in the hallway, his head against the door, jacket unzipped, eyes still closed, somehow sleeping while standing. 9-year-old Matt sat on the step, his sleepy head against the banister. "Dad, let the boys sleep. Your mother's dying, and this will be the last chance you have to see her." It was 11:30, and I found out my mom was dying. We sped to the hospital, Paul and Maddie crying in the back seat, and I sat silently in the front, not able to find tears. The streetlights cast brighter than normal that night, and I became aware of the subtlety of color difference that didn't exist before. We leapfrogged down the highway, traveling from pool of light to pool of light on a cold January highway. We entered the emergency room, and the whiteness of the walls somehow hurt my skin. And I remember the elevator for some reason, and not because it went too slowly, but that it went too fast. If I could, I would have spent the whole rest of the evening in the elevator. When we walked into the room, my mom was conscious. Her breathing was labored and rattling and chunky. She smiled and said hi. She had to speak between short breaths. I hadn't cried yet, but the image of her there, the washcloth on her forehead, the limp hands sitting next to her sides, and the smile, I couldn't keep it together anymore. "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean any of it. I'm sorry. I love you so much. I know." Maddie crawled in bed with her. I think I hugged her, but I'm not sure. I remember asking her if she was afraid, and she said yes, a little bit. And it's not what you want to hear. The woman who comforted me as a child and told me death was nothing to fear. Images from that night is what haunts me most now. The doctor folding down her dress to listen to her chest and leaving her breast exposed, but no one seeming to care. His comment about her lungs filling with fluid. Her falling asleep. Matt going to the lobby to watch the Disney Channel. The nurses at the station crying with a box of Kleenex amongst them. I sat with Paul and my dad, and we began talking about the logistics of the life in front of us. And it was somewhere in that conversation we realized that the labored breathing was no longer. Secretly, I was thankful. I'm not sure how much longer I could have sat and watched. It was 1 a.m., and it was either January 20th of a new day or the day that had just passed. But either way, that day marks, in my mind, the death. 20 years gone. More life I have lived in memories than I've had with her. 20 years gone. 20 years since childhood. Four of my own children, the joy, the conflict, the memories, she will never meet them, hold them, or feed them in the middle of the night. She will never meet the dear man I get to call my husband. Yet through this life, maybe they meet her and me. As the years pass, I see more of her. I see the dark freckles of age appear on my arms. I see the sag of extra weight on my hips. And I see her hands. The skin color is similar. And when my hands are dry, there's a deep groove that develops between them. My palms are ruddy and square and have the same appearance. I have my mother's hands. Maybe that is peace in itself.
Dana, that was incredibly powerful. I almost don't want to tell my story, but I'll do that anyways. My story is a conversation, and my story is about how I managed to spend $50,000 to get a master's program that would take my income from $350,000 a year to $50,000 a year. Now, I know they're teaching new math in schools these days, but that investment is not one that typically goes real well. But that is my story. And 15 years ago, almost to today, in early September, the story started, and I was sitting outside of my pool in an exclusive upscale neighborhood of Southern Pines, North Carolina. And in North Carolina in September, it can still be very warm and sunshiny, and I was sitting outside, sitting next to my pool, seeing the pine trees around me blowing just a little bit in the breeze and bright sunshiny day. And I was thinking about life, and I was contemplating where I was. You see, 15 years ago, I was a 27-year-old young man that had life by its tail. I had become the youngest person hired into a role at a corporation called Guidant. It's a medical device company, and some early research and development that I had done and some good timing and hard work had put me in a place of great success. I was married, happily married, and had two boys. I had a two-year-old and a newborn that was there with me, and everything was fine. I had all the toys that I could possibly imagine. But that year, something changed. And I committed to two little, powerful yeses in my life that would forever change the course of me and my family. You see, the first yes, the first powerful small yes, happened a few months prior. I was involved in our church, and we had a young youth pastor who had not finished much college. I think he had taken a couple classes, but after high school, he decided he didn't want to continue on. And so I told him, I said, if you commit to going to a Bible college, I'll take a class with you. That was a powerful small yes. And it was at that college, that little Bible college in Fayetteville, North Carolina, that I began to think about what could be. And I heard things in my life, and in my spiritual background was God speaking through my thoughts and friends and thinking about my time with my grandfather that was an old country doctor that practiced until he was 83 years old, and he made house calls. And as a young person, I would follow him around to these house calls in rural southern New Jersey. And I would think back on the things that he would say and do and not do with his patients. And he was much more of a counselor than he was actually a family medicine doctor. But I thought about those things as I was in these classes. And as I was sitting by my pool, I began to wonder, is this it? I'm 27 years old. I have just about everything I could possibly want. And is this it? Am I going to spend the next 20, 30, 40 years of my life just going through the motions? And then the second powerful little yes that happened that same late summer, early fall, was I agreed to go to a men's retreat that my church was having. Now, if you don't know me real well, I'm not really touchy-feely. I'm not a guy that likes to sit around. I know staff that's worked with me, we joke because, you know, if you cry in my office, I'm more likely to throw a tissue box at you than to sit and listen. And but that's just who I am. I'm not very touchy-feely. But as I began to kind of look forward to this men's retreat, I realized that Rick Oglesby, who was the teacher, the pastor of the class that I was taking at this little Bible college, was going to be there. And as I marched toward that time, that weekend, I began to get very nervous because I felt like I needed to tell someone that maybe I was being called to be a pastor. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't really know much about the training that was involved. But I sat down in that conference. I remember the room, and it was a very small room. And I asked Rick, I was petrified to talk to somebody about this, and my voice was shaking, and he sat me down. And I said, Rick, I've got this feeling, and I explained some of the things to him. And he asked me two questions. He said, Matt, are you in debt? And he said, and then second question, have you talked to your wife about this? I said, that's a stupid couple questions to ask, because I've just about decided to put my life in the Lord's hand and go into the good work of ministry. What kind of stupid question is that? And I said, well, yeah, I have some debt. I've got some school loans that are still there, and I have a nice new fancy car that I was paying for. And he said, well, let me give you two pieces of advice. They weren't, you know, Bible lessons or some class to take. It was, he said, Matt, get out of debt. And don't tell your wife for 6 months. I said, that's stupid. I was thinking, you know, she's got to take some class, doesn't she, to become a pastor's wife? You got to figure out how to do this kind of thing. He said, don't tell her. He said, Matt, I can see some things in your life that make a lot of sense. But I want you to give it time. And he was right. Because when I got myself out of debt, the little bit of debt that I had, and I put savings aside, it put me in a better place to do the things that we were able to do, which I don't have time to talk about. But it's a good story, maybe for next time. But the other thing was, is those 6 months allowed me to really understand what I was thinking and being confident and telling my wife. Now, when I told her, she thought I was nuts and that she had absolutely nothing to do, or she wanted nothing to do with this new journey, but ultimately she agreed. And we were able to serve in ministry. Now, I want you to fast forward another 10 years to 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I was on my way to go pick up my older two boys that were now 12 and 10. And they were participating in a Little League baseball camp near Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And we were living in the Buffalo, New York area. And I was driving south to Pennsylvania, and I was late. And as I was entering into the Pennsylvania line, as I pulled over to get some gas real quickly, I looked at my GPS, and I was trying to determine how in the world I could get to the game in time. See, they play a game at the very end of the camp, and my oldest son, Josh, was going to be pitching. It's the first time he's ever pitched, and I promised him on the phone the night before, I will be there for your very first pitch. So I'm going down in Pennsylvania, and I realize I'm going to be late. Unless I make another powerful small yes. And that powerful small yes that day was taking a shortcut. So I looked on my GPS and I saw this little line that went through the mountains, and I said, I'm taking that road. I have no idea what that road is, but I'm taking it. So I'm going down this two-lane highway. I get to the road. I make a left onto the smaller road, and I kid you not, the name of the road was called Back Road. I was literally on a back road in Pennsylvania. Now, all was good as I turned onto this road. It was paved and seemed relatively harmless. Quickly, that pavement turned to gravel. Quickly, the gravel turned to dirt. Quickly, this road looked more like a trail than a road would be in my late model Toyota minivan, Sienna minivan, which has about a 6-inch clearance, as I hit every rock and every pothole that I could possibly hit. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, the trees got closer and my GPS signal was lost. So as I was driving and I would nearly get stuck in the mud, I would look around and wonder, what in the heck am I doing? Because I had a choice at that moment. I didn't have the GPS. I had kind of remembered what turns I needed to make, but I wasn't 100% sure. But that powerful, simple yes put me on an opportunity to see my son pitch. But I was scared. I didn't know if I was going to make it through that road. I came to a Y, and the road was so narrow, that was really my only point to turn around if I wanted to. And I made a choice at that Y to go the direction that I thought and not turn around and take the safe route. I got to the game. I was able to see my son pitch. Literally, I think I was there 30 seconds before he threw his first pitch. And my son Josh will tell you that's one of the most meaningful experiences of his life. So powerful, simple yeses are all around us. And I would encourage you to think about that. As a matter of fact, this afternoon, I said a powerful, simple yes. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I'll tell you in another 5 years. Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's all we got. So I think we have 10 minutes to kick off, or I don't know, but thank you all for coming, honestly, and thank you to the speakers who put a lot of effort into, you know, thinking about what it is their story is to share, and having the guts to get up here. It takes you know, not a small amount of juju to put yourself out there. So thank you to those, to Matt and to Becca and to Kirsten. You know, please, there's a suggestion box over there. If you want to nominate yourself or you have someone you think would be a good speaker for one of these, please throw their name in the hat, and we'll see you all back here in a couple months. Thank you. Thank you.